So how are things going with you, Ralph, in being closer to God? And those were, you know, that was one of the prayer requests you'd given me. And do you have any other prayer requests or any other things that we can keep you in our prayers for?
Yeah. My quiet times are going well. I'm developing a good home Bible study group. We're right now doing a series from rightnow.org on work as worship, and that's being well received, good discussions, and I've got another group tonight. So things are good.
So the work is worship, what's the major takeaways on that?
Well, among other things, I'm going to do it for all my grandchildren that live on the farm, because I think it's just the biggest lack. I'm seeing it as they go to college, in college, and graduating from college, and graduating from high school, that they haven't got a clue what life and work is all about. That's totally vanishing from the culture, which means you haven't got a clue what calling is. So you will notice that young people are desperately seeking significance, and they're trying to find significance in all the wrong places. So many of them chase ideologies, chase, you know, anything that will give them a feeling of belonging. And yet God has called each of us to contribute and given us skills to do it, and takes great pleasure in us when we do it. And that gives us joy. But if you can't relate to that, have no idea about that, then I think you miss the joy. And I see that in terms of depression, confusion, fear, all kinds of inappropriate behaviors, trying to substitute. And so this right now has, I've discovered, is one of the hubs of good Christian teaching videos. They just collect an awful lot of them. And this is one by J.D. Greer, a pastor in North Carolina. And it's got a lot of good case studies of young people in all kinds of jobs and walks of life, and how they got there, and how they are able to use their work as worship and as an outreach and blessing to other people. So that's been good.
You mentioned you were going to do it with your grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's that going to look like?
I don't know what it's going to look like. There are six videos, and the way I do these things is the videos that range from 18 minutes to 27 minutes, and if you put that in an hour with some discussion, I think and I hope that it doesn't exceed the attention span, and gives them something to think about. Plus, it's in video format, which seems to be right up the alley of their generation.
Are these online?
Oh, yeah. Huh. You can find them at rightnow.org, plus a lot of other good stuff.
Gotcha. See, it's interesting because
C12 bought all of our members sort of a membership in that.
Gotcha.
Oh, which gives us access to all of them.
It's interesting because, like, you know, Ginger Ann, our oldest, she and her husband have been married, I think it's been 3.5 years now, and they have a little guy that is almost 2 years old, and then she's pregnant with their second one that's going to be a little guy. And so he's due at the same time the other one turns two, so they're going to have two boys that are, you know, two and under. And so I thought about doing a project, a collaborative project with, I don't know, I guess anybody that want to be involved that would go ahead and, like, give insight for, like, two and under, and then 2 to 5, and then 5 to 10, and then 10 to 15, and then 15 to 20, and then, I don't know, 20 to whatever. Like, as parents, like, what would be, like, trying to squeeze out the nuggets? I mean, there was something that was shared to me by a client of ours, and he was in the mortgage industry, and he said he taught his kids, probably, I don't know, teen, preteen years. He said relationships are a lot like applying for a mortgage. And, you know, you have, like, credit, and you have collateral, you know, and then you have cash. And any one of those can be, you know, a little short, and others can make up for it. But none of them overcome the others. And he said, so, you know, when my daughter's starting to date, it's like, you know, hey, you can have a guy that, you know, is good looking and talented and funny and athletic. And those are, nothing's wrong with all of those, but none of them make up for a lack of character.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, there's some deal breakers. There's some things that, you know, hey, what are the most important things to you? And it's interesting because, like, my wife, we were married when she was 19, I was 20. We met going to Faith Baptist Bible College in Ankeny, Iowa. We were high schoolers, and my dad, who's a pastor, knew her pastor. And so he said, hey, I've got a young lady that, you know, wants to check out the college during college days. You know, how about if, can you take her down? So I drove her in my car, and that's where we connected and got to know each other a little bit. And then she showed up on campus, and we were just real close friends because we knew, you know, I knew somebody on campus. And so we really started off as very close friends. And some of the guys she dated, I'm like, yeah, I don't know that's so great. I mean, even at a Christian college, I'm like, I don't know. And I knew she liked me, but I just was like, I don't know. And my brother's fiance at the time, they were in the same dorm. And so my brother, he was going to college, and his fiance was there. And so she really tried working hard to get my wife and I together to date. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. And we were in a class, and my wife had just broken up with, you know, one of the guys she had dated. And she said to me, she says, you know, do you have any suggestions on how I can pick better guys or whatever? And I said, well, you know, write a list down of what you're looking for in, you know, your ideal husband. And so she came back the next day with her list, and I don't know, there were 10 things on it or whatever. And I said, oh, that's good. And she really won my heart with what she said next. She said, you know, since you asked me to do that and I did that, you know, what do you think about you writing down what you're looking for? And I knew that she wanted to date me. And so I'm like, now here's a smart woman. You know, here's somebody, she's sharp. I mean, she, you know, she's after something and she knows how to get it. That's really intriguing to me. So it was at the beginning of the class, and so at the end of the class, I gave her a list, and I don't know, there were like 30 items on it. And I had really spent probably from the age of, I don't know, 13, thinking about the kind of wife that I wanted to have. And I mean, I had this list down to an absolute T. I mean, I knew what I was looking for. I was very, very intentional on selecting a wife. And then very intentional on raising children. I mean, far, far more intentional than my parents. And I don't know that even with all the intentionality and all the work, it seemed like my parents, I don't know, I wouldn't say they just kind of let us grow up, but it kind of seems like that. And my, you know, the final chapter has not been written on my kids, but I, you know, I look and I say, I mean, my oldest, she's very intentional like I am. The other ones, not so much. And I spent, I observed being a pastor's kid and a missionary's kid. I observed, like, a lot of the families that came through counseling and a lot of the you know, going to stuff. And it's like I observed that the fourth generation of Christians tends to be at great risk. Like, the first generation often has no knowledge, you know, so they just kind of fall into it, and they become Christians, and they don't know the Bible, they don't know other stuff, but they've got so much energy and passion that God somehow, you know, gives them grace from their lack of knowledge because their passion and because they're fresh and they're in love and, you know, with Christ and everything. And the first generation says, hey, you know, we didn't have all the training. So the first generation worked really hard to the second generation to give them all the knowledge. Uh-huh. And the second generation has like tons of knowledge, but not really a legacy, not a history. You know, I mean, their parents, you know, but nothing beyond that. And so the second generation has more knowledge than the first generation, but not as much of passion. When it gets to the third generation now has grandparents and parents, and they have momentum, they have a legacy. But then something like, you know, something, I don't know, happens. And then the fourth generation, you know, it's like all the wheels come off.
Well, and, you can trace that exact theme through the book of Revelation, the messages to the churches, and the first generation has the love, but then you've lost your first love. And then there's a church that had good doctrine, but they lost the first love. So, you know, it's a lot in what you say.
So I realized this as a teenager. I mean, nobody sat me down and said, hey, Mark, this is what you need to do. And my kids are the fourth generation. And so I'm like, okay, the combination of fourth generation, the combination of the society not embracing Christian values like my parents, you know, when my dad grew up on the farm and stuff, you, even if you had neighbors that weren't Christian, they still, by and large, had Christian values.
Yeah.
Well, now it's like, you can have Christian neighbors, and they still might not have Christian values. And so I'm like, the combination of these things is going to be a bloodbath. And so, like, we homeschooled the kids. I spent 2 or 3 years researching in the Bible, coming up with a list of all the values from a biblical perspective, and then built a system that was incorporated into our, you know, into our home education and the homeschooling, that had a system of transferring values, you know, systematically, precise, intentionally. Because it seems like the Jews, the Jews are very intentional in the training of future generations. And it seems like God was very intentional with the Jewish nation on how to, you know, like cornerstones and all the holidays. Like, it's a continued reminder that God is there. And it seems like Americans don't have, you know, any passageway into being a man. You just, like the Indians, the knights, I mean, a lot of the previous, like other cultures and past cultures had like a rite of manhood, like a passageway, where us, it seems like, you know, we don't have a passageway at all. It's like, you know, and so we, I mean, I worked so hard, so intentional, and it doesn't seem like it worked. And so, like, with when this guy Glenn shared this thing about the parents, or about the mortgages similar to, you know, the mortgage is similar to relationships, and so you need to do that. Like, I knew that, but nobody taught it to me, at least intentionally, and I don't know that my kids, you know, picked it up. Like, I don't know that they picked it up. And it's like, you know, I picked it up, and I think my siblings picked it up, but I don't think my kids picked it up, and some of the cousins, I don't know if, I mean, I don't know.
Well, you know, when you're talking about kids and intentionality and teaching them, my experience is that your kids will do virtually nothing of what you tell them and teach them, and they will do everything that you do, which is extremely frustrating. But all it does is tell you that they learn by observation, not by listening and memorization. And so I think that we owe it to our kids and the next generation to be as transparent with them as we possibly can, to open our lives and thinking to them, not in terms of instruction of this is what you should do and this is how you handle situations, et cetera, but this is what I do, this is what motivates me, and becomes a case study for them. And parents are a very much more important case study than they think they are, because children pattern themselves after their parents. And yet they want, what we all want is the freedom to make decisions. And that's in all of us, because God gave us free will, a very dangerous thing. And that means that they don't own a philosophy or a worldview unless they've experimented with it and found that it is true and closer to the reality of life any other. But unless they start with something, they have no entry point, nothing to compare. So when you're talking about particularly young kids, you know, the 2-3-year-olds, the 5-year-olds, the 7-year-olds, they're not in a position to learn a whole lot, but they are in a position to observe you, listen to you, listen to stories, listen to how you interact with them. And from that, at a very early age, they learn relationships and how to interact with people. And it's more by osmosis than by any principle that you can teach them at that age. But it's very important to spend time with them. And I always felt it was important to spend time with them first thing in the morning. That's the only time you can probably get their full attention. And it's got to be fun, appropriate to the age. So it's really not so much the content of the learning, but the communication that begins to open them to the realities of life. And I went through the whole of Scripture with my kids at a very young age, just bit by bit. And each chapter or verse or what have you just opened itself up to some questions and discussion. And some of it very silly, but instructive anyway, and primarily fun. And I found that later on, as they reached 30, 40, and 50, that it was important and became a basis of who they are in a strange way. So, I don't know. The other thing is your relationship with grandchildren is kind of different from your relationship with your children. You could kind of have to tailor it to the dynamics of the family and what is possible in their proximity to you. So,
see, and that's where with technology, like, you know, I mean, my grandfather passed away when I was 9. And when I hit 40, all of a sudden there was this tremendous sense of loss. So 10, 15 years ago, there's this tremendous sense of loss in not having him around. And so that impacted me significantly. I'm like, I don't know that I saw my grandfather. I didn't live close to us, and so I don't know if I saw him 10 times in my life.
Yeah, well.
But he made a significant impact. He made a massive, massive impact on my life with those 10 times, and it was just, you know. So to me, it's just strange. It's like, okay, Mark, he had a tremendous impact, massive impact on my life. And then for, you know, 25, 30 years, it was like dormant. And then all of a sudden, it came out of nowhere.
So what was the significance of his life? What was the essence of his life to you?
Well, the things that, you know, the things that I learned from him, the most significant thing I learned from him is when I was probably 8, he said to me, he said, you know, Mark, when somebody says something to you, there's some amount of truth to it. It could be 1% or 99%. There's some amount of truth, and it's not really up to them to tell you what percentage of truth. You need to take whatever you need to take and apply whatever you need to apply. And so what I learned from that is that there's truth in everything, and so it eliminated, like, defensiveness from my life. It's like, Mark, just determine how much truth. And it taught me ownership. So remove all defensiveness and take personal ownership in what you're doing. And he said that to me probably once, and that's it. I mean, I remember playing checkers with him, and he would always decimate me. Always. He'd never let me win. And so he's like, you know, I'm not gonna let you win just to let you win to feel good. You're gonna have to work for it. And so that probably was pretty significant too. He was a hard worker. His personality seems to be, you know, like mine, you know, pretty direct, pretty driven, can be abrasive to people at times. My grandmother, she's 98, and she's still alive. And so he passed away when he was in his 50s. So I think about, you know, when Ginger Ann was born, was like, I don't think I've asked you, like what would be one suggestion or a suggestion you would give on for me to be, like, the best grandfather on the planet? What would be a suggestion to be a great grandfather?
That's difficult. I'm still working on it. But I find it difficult by distance. Because, you know, your grandkids, or my grandkids, are all into Facebook and this and that and the other. And they are, I just can't relate in those things.
Right.
You know, I'm still in the email generation and barely got to that.
Right.
To them, that's no longer cool.
Right.
But I do have three of my grandchildren here on the farm, and we have a very good relationship because I see them all the time, and they know that I listen to them when they're down, and, you know, I'm kind of there for them. But that's hard to do with grandchildren that are far away.
See, it's interesting. My two nieces, like, I get on the phone with them every week on Saturday at 3 o'clock. And I've been doing that for now probably 6 or 7 years.
Uh-huh.
And so since they were 5 and 7. And it's amazing how I've gotten to know them and how close I am to them.
That's good.
You know, we were at a family reunion, and one of them was down. Just, you know, kind of sad. And it's weird because I knew exactly why she was sad, because there were a bunch of dogs running around, and her dog had just died a few months earlier. And so I'm like, I bet you it's just bringing back just tons of memories for her. And so she's now 12, 13. And so I remembered when, you know, when my dog died when I was, you know, in sixth grade, got killed by a car. And so I went to her parents, my brother and his wife. I said, hey, I think Brianna's down because of, you know, her puppy, her dog dying. And so you might just want to keep an eye on it. And you know, just, I don't know, help. And so they talked to her, and then April, my brother's wife, came to me, and she said, you know, hey, you're right. That's exactly what was there. That's really cool that you saw that. And I said, well, you know, that's what happens when you talk every week to somebody. You get to know them,
yeah,
even if it's for 10 or 15 minutes. And so she said, could you take him on a walk, and could you kind of help him through this? And I'm like, yeah, sure, love to. And so we talked about death, and we talked about life, and we talked about, I mean, all kinds of phenomenal, spectacular things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really amazing. And that happened because my brothers and I got together for a guy's, you know, my three brothers and I hung out. And my brother said, you know, my girls, my family aren't really connected because they're out in the D.C. area. And so they don't really connect with any of their uncles that much or cousins that much. And so I said, well, I'll connect. And one of the major driving forces is when my kids hit teenage years, I didn't have deep, deep connections with relatives. And so when they hit the really hard times, they didn't have the forged relationship outside of my wife and I, which really got tested. And so they went through some really difficult times that I think if they would have been more connected, family members, uncles and aunts and grandparents, that maybe the uncles and aunts and grandparents could have helped to navigate through that.
Well, you know, it's hard. It's hard sometimes to think things through without verbalizing them. And to verbalize them properly, you have to have a good, trusted listener. And I find that most people's biggest lack, whether they know it or not, is that nobody ever listens to them. I mean, really listens to them. There's nobody that they can kind of think out loud with.
So what would be a good listener? Like when you say listening to your kids, your grandkids, that's really like you really listen to them. Like, what is it that you do when you're listening to them?
Well, listening to them really, it amounts to, I think, or starts with good questions, and then the following the Holy Spirit's lead to shut up when he says shut up. That even with silences. And I find that listening is more of a spirit-led thing than speaking or anything else. Because if you come up with questions that show true concern and not judgment, then desire on the part of most people to be able to open up to somebody who will listen. But a sort of knee-jerk reaction that says, hey, they're not going to listen to it. They wouldn't understand. And I think when you reach a point with somebody that communicates that maybe they won't understand, but they're going to try hard to understand, and they're not going to make a judgment until they do understand, and they don't have an agenda. This conversation is all about my agenda, not their agenda.
Huh.
I think, however you can communicate that, I kind of think that's what it takes to get that kind of communication relationship going.
See, it just is interesting. Like when I was 40, I thought, man, I need to go ahead and I wish I knew at 20 what I now know at 40. That would have been really cool. And I thought, I bet you when I'm 60, I'm going to wish I knew at 40 what I know at 60.
Well, I don't know. It would spoil all your fun.
I don't know. So then I said, well, Mark, how can you accelerate the learning process? How can you learn in 3 or 4 or 5 years what most people learn in 20? And it's like, well, just talk to guys in their 60s. I mean, and ask them, because people are always willing to say. So you just say, hey, when you were 40, what do you wish you had known at 40 that you now know at 60? And men will tell you. They'll be like, oh, this is what I wish I knew. And the wisdom in that is just really powerful. So when I first became a grandparent, grandfather 2 years ago, I'm like, I bet you there's a whole lot of wisdom, out there for grandfathers that if I just ask grandfathers, experienced grandfathers that have been grandfathers for years, I could learn and be a lot better grandfather. So I started asking, and my uncle, he went ahead, when I asked him, he said, Mark, tell stories. He said, grandkids love stories.
Right.
And that changed my life. I had never connected. I would not tell my grandkids stories of me. And I thought that's not only good advice for, grandparents, but probably parents. So that was significant. Tom Kuntz, he said, focus on your, don't focus on the grandkids. Focus on their parents. And that was really profound to me. And that was like, wow. That's really intriguing.
Yeah.
And I've asked a number, those two stand out. I ask a lot of people, a lot of grandparents, but those are the two that really stood out. And then yours, be a really good listener. And I'm like, okay, that's a third one. Oh my God. Okay. And then what I need to do is I need to figure out how to be a listener, because like as a grandfather, it's like you have to listen different than as a parent, maybe. Maybe not, I don't know. But I'm not convinced I'm a good listener.
Very different because, a parent has a responsibility to some extent for a child's behavior and safety, well-being, this, that, and the other. A grandparent doesn't, and so where a parent cannot hear things from a child that they say, oh, my Lord, if I don't say something, this is dangerous what they're thinking, doing, etc. A grandparent can. Because that's not the grandparents' responsibility, that's the parents' responsibility. And so kids can share things with their grandparents that they can't share with their parents. And, I can remember when I was 19, 20, and so on, used to spend summers with my grandmother. And, she and I would talk and talk and talk in the morning. And she was a great listener. And especially kids in their late teens, early 20s, they got an awful lot of questions. It's a confusing time. And somebody who will just listen and let them talk it out. Their parents are more in the role of guiding them into the right direction. The grandparents are more in the role of letting them talk it out, think it out, and guide themselves in the right direction. And it comes more squarely in line with 2 Timothy 2:24. So, it's a different role, but it's a good role.
So how do you, as a grandparent, how do you know if you, when to share things with the parents and when not to?
Well, that's the point is you don't. For instance, I have a relationship with CEOs of companies in my C-12. I also have a relationship with their key players, vice presidents, etc., in a separate day. And if I started sharing what I hear in the key players with their bosses, that would be a disaster. You know, we have a rule, what is said in the room stays in the room. So I know certain things and attitudes and so on that really the CEO ought to know, but I can't tell him. And sometimes that's very frustrating. Sometimes, however, I can communicate some principles by way of questions without revealing what I actually know. But in the process, I can get them thinking about the problem. And pretty soon they'll know it. They already know what the problem is. They just haven't faced up to it and made it a priority. And sometimes I can get them thinking in a direction that will get them to resolve the problem that they've got. But I can't go to them and say, hey, you know, your employee so-and-so thinks this or is doing this or is about to quit. That would be strictly unethical and would lose the confidentiality and the openness that we try to get in those meetings. And there's a lot of openness there. So,
yeah, that's so.
And that's the kind of the same thing you've got with grandchildren.
Yeah, it's very cool. And so if everybody knows that, hey, that's how it is, you know, then it forces the parent to go ahead and be more attentive, a better listener to the grandparent.
Well, yeah, the parent will then start discussing the child with the grandparent, knowing that the grandparent is both interested and informed, but not going to break the confidentiality. However, there's other ways to get information out of somebody. If you know how to ask the right questions, you can get a lot of information without breaking confidentiality.
So have you ever talked to, like, have you ever shared this with your grandchildren or your children, what you just shared with me?
No.
Does everybody just kind of know it?
Why would I?
Well, how does everybody know, like,
if this is the way the relationships are, then everybody knows it. And if it's not, it doesn't do any good to say it is. But see, with the grandchildren I have that live on the farm, I know what's going on, and we're all concerned about each other. We're a family, and you know, like how kind of works. And but we know what the problems are. We know what the kids are going through and so on. We discuss issues like one would in a family. But it's, I find it hard to have that kind of relationship with those that are way off in Atlanta.
Gotcha.
And really, I should get down there more often, but I'm not sure if that would do it.
Well, I appreciate, you know, that this was, you know, most helpful. And, you know, I'm going to share this with my kids and my parents and my brothers and sisters and say, hey, here might be something, you know, here might be some things that, because there's stuff like there's stuff that, like in looking at retrospect, there's things that happens in families that if you had known, you could have done it differently. But you didn't know. You just didn't know. You didn't, never even crossed your mind. You're totally unaware. You know, and so my parents physically disciplined, you know, the grandkids.
Yeah.
And the four brothers are pretty much like, well, if you misbehave, you get disciplined. So the four brothers, not a problem at all. I mean, it's like, yeah, that's cool. But the wives, I think there were maybe issues with the wives, but the husbands maybe didn't know about it. The wives maybe didn't even, like, there was something that wasn't quite right there. And the kids definitely had, you know, the grandkids definitely had some challenges with it. But it's like nobody was aware of, nobody, it was just like, well, yeah, that's grandpa and grandma, and the dads are okay with it. The moms are not vocally against it, probably in most cases. They don't want to go against their husbands, and so, but it wasn't like it wasn't the best situation.
Well, see, yeah, there is a point, and it's a very fuzzy line, which if you cross, you have kind of violated the chain of command. You usurped the authority of the mother in that situation, and that's a real fuzzy line, and that can depend sometimes on family dynamics and a lot of other things.
Well, I think the thing is too. I think my parents. I don't know if my parents ever went ahead and transitioned from being parents into grandparents.
Well, that can be. Once again, it's dependent on circumstances. It can be quite different if everybody lives together.
Well, nobody did, and that's the other thing. Like, I don't think my parents recognized the power of a grandparent, like the influence. I don't think they were aware of it. Like, you're getting disciplined all the time by your parents if you're not a good kid. And so you just, that's all the time. But with grandparents, if you don't live with them, and you see them not a lot, infrequently, and the few times you do see them, you get disciplined from them. Like, I think a grandparent's words, and especially words and physical discipline, I think it does a lot more to a child. It has a bigger impact on a child. And if you don't recognize that as a grandparent that listen, your way, it's almost like being up in front of people. Like if you're a leader up in front of people and you say something in front of a whole group of people, that's really heavy-handed. Whereas if you're a peer saying, hey, you're kind of sloppy and undisciplined, you know, peer to peer, it has one impact. But if you're up in front of people and you say, hey, you're sloppy and disciplined, that's like a 10-ton sledgehammer coming down on somebody.
Yeah, well, that's the shame factor.
And And I'm not saying that a grandparent shouldn't use it, but they better know what they're doing when they lower that hammer, because that is going to have a lifelong impact, you know, on a grandchild.
Yeah.
And I don't know if my parents were, you know, were aware of that when it was happening. And so, and I share this with some other couples that are our age and they're now kids are married, and I shared it with one, and he's like, man, I never thought of that before. He says, I'm glad you shared that with me, because I would have thought nothing of spanking one of my grandkids. He said, but now I'm going to think twice about it, and there's going to be a little more collaboration, you know, with the parents. And,
yeah.
And so there's, like, there's these things, like, that are common sense, I think, to you, Ralph, for whatever reason. That are not common sense to other people.
Well, you know, when your kids grow up, it's their marriage, their family, and so they've assumed a responsibility. And with that responsibility goes an authority. And you can't usurp that authority, nor can you jump the chain of command. You know, Scripture talks about you have no authority over another man's servant. And so you gotta watch the boundaries. And that's all what's involved in the mother-in-law and daughter-in-law relationship, which is always very tense.
Huh. Well, I appreciate it, Ralph. Thank you.
Okay.
We'll see ya.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you're listening to the rebroadcast of this, you have any questions, feel free to connect with the individual who invited you to participate in today's session, or you can call toll-free 888-230-2300. That's 888-230-2300. Or if you're calling outside the U.S., you can call the U.S.-based number at 630-393-9909. That's 630-393-9909. God bless and have a great day. Bye-bye.